the fan. On demand. Log on to Sportsnet590.ca. Sign up to automatically receive the latest reports, features, and Fan 590 show highlights. You gotta get up pretty early in the morning to get one over on these guys. Because they get up at like 3 a.m. You're listening to Brady and Lang on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
5:30, it's Brady and Lang. Good morning, Greg Brady, Jim Lang, Mike Farwell for Monday, March the 2-5. We are a week and a day out from Blue Jays opening day. When we talk to you next Monday, it'll be April, and there will be a Major League Baseball game having been played. The Astros and Houston, Texas Rangers the night before. We begin with hockey. The king is dead. Long live the king in the Northeast Division. The Toronto Maple Leafs take the belt from the Boston Bruins Saturday night in a 3-2 win that had a little bit of everything, and they'll play again tonight on Sportsnet 590. The revenge match. I don't think Boston's ever wanted any. I mean, maybe on the par with Game 7 against the Canucks, but I don't think the Bruins have ever wanted a game like this one tonight.
Although, in all seriousness, I'm pretty sure Claude Julien would like a bit of a better effort from his team. To have Milan Lucic not have a shot on goal Saturday night couldn't have sat very well with him, even though they outshot the Leafs in the game. And bizarre to think the Leafs only had 13 shots on goal on Matt Sundin night and still won the game. But despite the shots that the Leafs didn't have, they made some good plays. Like Fraser running over Lucic along the side of the board.
That was nice.
The fourth line getting a goal. Kadri stripping the D for a highlight reel goal. They did some things that I can't think Julien would be very happy about. And Boston can play much better than that.
And James Reimer, too. I think you got to give the guy a nod, right? We've talked about goaltending frequently early in the season. Goaltending seemed to be the reason the Leafs were doing as well as they were. Maybe hit a tiny bit of a bump in the road, but Reimer full marks for that performance on Saturday night.
Yeah, he was incredible. And I thought he was very, very good in the third period Thursday against the Buffalo Sabres. So we're pretty sure he'd get the start again tonight going against Boston. And, of course, Montreal keeps winning in the division. There's no easy games the rest of the way, but the Leafs gave themselves a little bit of a cushion. It's so funny how it works, though. It was a great win. It's one of the best wins we've seen the Leafs have on home ice probably since they stopped making the playoffs year after year, in terms of not outplaying a team, but just winning a game, the emotional feeling of the fans there. Yeah, Matt Sundin being back. And yet you look, and New Jersey won that night. And last night you get a three-point game with the Rangers in Washington. You get Winnipeg winning again. It's, you know, Philadelphia hanging in and getting a point against Pittsburgh. So it's all about math. It's all about math and beating the teams. Even if you can't win tonight in Boston, you got Florida and Carolina at home. You got two games left against the Capitals, two games left against the Rangers. They're all so big.
Well, and the Capitals now, all of a sudden, quietly, they've come to life. Yeah. Ovechkin, 7 goals in 7 games. The Caps have won 3 in a row. And out of the, I mean, no one had given them a hope of coming back in this race, including myself, Greg. Craig Brady, yes,
no,
I know.
Humble Brady. Actually, I don't know. I've been up and down on the Capitals.
I don't want you to pop your shoulder out of the joint, patting yourself on the back. But
no,
they
be a bit of a twist move there.
Ovechkin, for whatever reason, decided to play like he can again, and he scored a dynamite goal in the shootout in that win over the Rangers last night. I mean, yeah. Lundqvist didn't have a hope.
Plus, name me a star player that's playing with less talent around him than Alexander Ovechkin right now. There's not too many. This is not a very good team. It's not a very deep team. Backstrom doesn't look like Backstrom used to. Green doesn't look like Green used to.
He lost Semin to Carolina.
Yeah, and outside of that, I mean, you know.
No, there isn't one.
Who's Alex Ovechkin supposed to pass the puck to? But, yeah, to get back to the Leafs, it was a great performance. It was a great win. We got lots to do this morning on the Leafs with a good win over the Boston Bruins. I would bet bottom dollar, dollars to donuts, whatever makes you hungry, that Tuukka Rask will start tonight. Anton Khudobin's not a bad goaltender, not by a long shot, but he had a very bad night on, at one point, what, three on nine shots, I believe it was. It was the McLaren pretty goal that he got might have been the 10th shot. They might have credited him two just because he's so big going to the net. But they had 9 shots to start the third period, and I believe the first shot or second shot went in. On that between the legs play, and I'm telling you, Khudobin's probably never been more embarrassed after he saw the video of it.
Now, the Leafs get Luupil back from suspension tonight, but Lyles did not make the trip because of the sprained ankle. At first, I actually thought he had his foot cut where he collided with the Bruins player along the boards.
Like Erik Karlsson.
Exactly. That's exactly what I thought it was, Greg. Yeah. There's his Achilles or his calf got sliced, but they're just seeing a sprained ankle, but he's on a Boston, so I hate to say it, Who's in the blue line of places?
Koska.
Koska. Because someone has mentioned Holzer. They, please, no. It's got to be Koska, not Holzer.
Well, you know, the Holzer's contract goes for another 25 months. So it's not... 5:35, loads to do this morning, and we will talk to James Hinchcliffe on the dawn of a brand new era in Canadian IndyCar racing. The race was on Sportsnet from St. Petersburg yesterday. James Hinchcliffe driving Dan Weldon's GoDaddy car gets his first ever IndyCar victory to start the season, no less, a week after he was in studio with us. So if you have something coming up, if you have, like, you know, a tough tax return or, you know, you got to give a good sermon on Easter Sunday, you might want to come in studio with us this week. We give good vibes for a change.
You're going to have all these salesmen with PowerPoint presentations calling you now, yeah. You know.
Harvey Brooker, I got your name. I got your ass. Get in here. And it's smaller than it used to be. I got it, Harvey. 5:35, it's Brady and Lang. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Now, more of Brady and Lang on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
James Hinchcliffe is on his way to his very first win in the Izod IndyCar Series. He's been on the podium twice before, but the mayor of Hinchtown is now an IndyCar Series winner. GoDaddy goes to victory lane.
Was the IndyCar season opener, was on Sportsnet, and the first Canadian to win a race on the IndyCar circuit in 6 years since Paul Tracy did it. James Hinchcliffe gets the season off with a bang in St. Petersburg. Just a remarkable achievement. Does it in Dan Weldon's hometown. They unveiled a monument for the late Dan Weldon, who, of course, died in an IndyCar race 2 years ago. That was done on Thursday. But the Oakville, Ontario native got past Helio Castroneves, Spider-Man, on the final restart to take the lead and win by a second and a little bit.
I just been in and out of the race all day, and I started watching.
You were
going in and out.
Like, okay. All right. I don't know. Some people have double lives. I don't know.
I could barely drive my own Honda, let alone one of these cars. And
you don't have to park it. You just have to drive it.
Exactly. Good point. I switched about lap 84, and I just saw him pass Castroneves, and he made a beautiful move inside because Neves' back tire slid a little bit, and he saw just enough of an opening to make the pass in a turn. And Hinchcliffe knew he had 25 laps to go, and they have the camera on the rear wing looking back to the car behind you. And Neves was right on his butt the whole way for the last 25 laps. At one point, the difference was 0.4 of a second between the two cars going whatever speed down the break straightaways, 300K. It was a tremendous race by Hinchcliffe because he had no margin for error because Castroneves was on him waiting for the slightest little mistake to make him pay, and he never did it.
It's funny, only four races they have till the Indy 500. We've obviously never had it would be incredible to have, you know, him win the Indy 500, but there's races in Alabama, Long Beach, and they take a bit of a protracted break in there in Sao Paulo, Brazil. In the streets of Sao Paulo. I love that Michael Douglas show from the 70s. And then they go to Indy, and then later on here in the summer, obviously. But I'm so glad for Hinchcliffe. We were talking with Patrick Chan last week, and we're talking about Patrick Chan to James Hinchcliffe the Friday he was in when the World Figure Skating Championships were going on. And he echoed, you know, what it is. It's if you do well in Canada, it's amazing how much attention you get among 33 people compared to an American racer doing this with everything else going on. And it's just such a crowded sports landscape. But if you can do what Mike Weir did 10 years ago at the Masters, if you could ever win a Grand Slam of your Milos Raonic or what Hinchcliffe did, it's your ticket's written for life. Not that that's why you do it, but it's true.
He's 26 years old, and he's sort of paid his dues and done it the right way. And he was so personable in when studio with us. He's really made his known around the IndyCar circuit as being someone who's comfortable in his own skin, can handle dealing with sponsors and corporate people and media and fans alike, and does it with ease and gets in the car. And he was stone cold yesterday, and it was hot and humid in Florida. And I missed Brian Johnson of AC/DC, lives not far from the area. And
he joined
Rob Falls in the pregame little hit they did with Paul Tracy.
They have similar voices. I've always said exactly. That Rob Falls is the Brian Johnson of sports play-by-play broadcasting.
Exactly.
He's belted
it
out.
But for Hinchcliffe to win it, and you know, I know it sounds kind of hokey, Greg, but there was that twinge of Canadian pride. He hops out of the cockpit. In victory lane with the Canadian flag behind him. And that was kind of a cool moment.
Yeah. We'll see how far it can go. Like, you look back at some of the amazing triumphs. And the very first racer I remember was Gilles Villeneuve, obviously. Like, in the early 80s, passes away, obviously doing, you know, what he loved. Didn't love that happened, and none of us did. But then Jacques Villeneuve, I don't know, I was just sort of out of the loop. Jacques Villeneuve's the only Canadian ever to win the Indy 500, and he won it in 95. And I have no memory of that right now. I feel like it'll be a little more... significant, a little more significant if Hinchcliffe can get on a roll. And it might make me watch the Indy 500 cover to cover again like I used to when I was a kid. That and those three horse races, the Triple Crown, seem to be things I totally remember when I was 7, 8, 9, 10 years old as always watching, and I don't anymore. I don't.
And the difference between Hinchcliffe and Paul Tracy, and this is not to knock Paul Tracy, but he was never as smooth and comfortable and personable as Hinchcliffe. Tracy always had a bit of an edge to him, could be prickly at times. Mm-hmm. And Hinchcliffe has a golden opportunity now with this win, if he can build on it, Greg, especially at Indy, to capture the hearts and minds of racing fans in this country that we haven't seen in a long time.
What about, and I don't know, I was in the U.S. and I remember being in the Silverdome press box when Greg Moore passed away, and he had some promise as a racer, didn't he? But there weren't people thinking he was going to be, you know, I suppose one of the greatest. He's very, very good, and obviously we don't know how good he could have got because he only was on the circuit for 5 or 6 years.
And that is the problem, is that he was that...
Died at 24.
Everyone's thinking, well, if he had lived a couple more years, how many races would he have won? How great could he have been? And that's part of the appeal, I think, and in some way of people are racing, is they love the thrilling nature, the speed, but there's always a danger factor that draws some people to any form of racing.
Hinchcliffe's a year older now than when Greg Moore passed away.
Yeah, so. Yeah, and he only got a ride because of Weldon passing away. That's the only reason he got on the GoDaddy team.
Mm. It was nice of him to pay tribute to Dan Weldon, too, in some of his post-race comments. But I think you're so on the mark when you talk about the ability here for Hinchcliffe to step up and capture the hearts and imaginations of Canadian race fans. In fact, he's probably done that to some degree now. I'm thinking about the Indy here, too, and just imagine what could happen if he can finish that one in first place, and that'll take it, you know, right over the top.
Yeah, like, they're big events, but I feel like it's kind of, they come and go, and the big fans are the big fans, but it's you got to cross over. You got to get out of the A1 racing fan and hit the general Canadian sports fan. And Hinchcliffe now has got the opportunity to do it. I wouldn't have said that before this week.
And he's hip enough and young enough that he could go on a music video show. He could go on
none of us can do that now. I don't know any of these fans.
No, he can. I can't. But no, he could go on more
you
than
can
just
name More One Direction songs than he can.
I really, really
I probably
wish
could
I could
name half of them. I know when they're on and when they're not.
Yeah, but he could go on different forms of media and sell himself and sell the sport, especially when the Indy comes to town here.
Yeah.
And if he does well at Indianapolis, Greg, well, his Q factor in the city, his rating is going to be off the charts.
Yeah, so they go to Birmingham, Alabama. It'll be on Sportsnet a week and a half from now, April 7th. Not much on the Blue Jays front. They now have the worst, who cares, right? They now have the worst record in Grapefruit League play among all the teams that are playing in Florida, amidst the American League and National League teams. But there won't be any, I don't know that there is a story the rest of the way that will top Ricky Romero. Ricky Romero is scheduled to pitch 6 innings tomorrow for the Blue Jays, and we'll see. It got really hairy. It got a lot of attention last week when he pitched and wasn't good at all. And then the next day, although mostly against minor league Boston Red Sox, people who will start with Pawtucket, their Triple A team, Jay Happ threw 6 shutout innings. I mean, I thought to myself over the weekend, I'm really good. If I can make it till Tuesday and not have to hear any more about Romero and Happ, and certainly not have to talk any more about it, I'll be happy. And yet I am fascinated to see how Ricky Romero does tomorrow against they play the Pittsburgh Pirates tomorrow at home in Dunedin. And Romero will go, and it'll mostly be the big squad. It'll be the Andrew McCutchins, and it'll be Travis Snyder, and it'll be the rest of the Pirates.
More than just the hits he may or may not give up, I think for Romero, the big thing is how many batters will he walk? And that was the big thing from the previous outing, the minor league outing, walking 5 minor leaguers and struggling to find the strike zone. And if he can't find the strike zone and walks a bunch of hitters again, that's the big alarm bell for any Blue Jays fan or anybody in the organization.
Yeah, and if he can't beat the minor league squad that he basically faced the last time out, then what's he going to do against the regulars there with the Pittsburgh Pirates, McCutchen and company? It's going to be, look, this is a big one. This is absolutely a big one for Ricky Romero. We've talked about how long the leash is, and it doesn't appear to be very long with Jay Happ sitting right there waiting in the wings.
Yeah, it does sound like Buffalo, from my guess, and some of it is based on what you hear, and some of it's just a feel for it. Buffalo's the third option for Ricky Romero. The first option's he pitches well. They're comfortable with bringing him north. He can find the plate enough, and he's the fifth starter, and he'll start against the Red Sox the weekend after this coming. The second option is probably to leave him in Florida, give him an extended spring training, and put him on the DL and just denote that his shoulder is nagging and bothering him and let him pitch his way out of this. But once he goes to Buffalo, that's it's almost like we're more worried about his feelings than we are the average player about shuffling between the Leafs and the Marlies, or you're in, you're out, you're in, you're out. We're really worried about how he quote unquote feels going to Buffalo if that's what happens, instead of just saying get four starts, throw to AAA batters, hit the plate, get your confidence back, get it over the plate. Then we'll recall you, obviously.
Right, because if he does accomplish all that, Greg, by May, this will all be forgotten. If he's back to where he was before, pitching every 5 days and being effective, no one will remember if he had to have a couple starts in AAA to get back onto his game.
Yeah, yeah. Let's do Now and Then. It's 5:51.
Now on Brady and Lang. Now and Then. A contemplative and reflective look back on great and not-so-great snapshots in time. And 4 minutes of radio Greg and Jim don't have to come up with on their own. Not exactly a string.
1982, on this date, Wayne Gretzky became the first player in the NHL to score 200 points in a season. It feels like we're early in the season, but he did this in just his third NHL year. He would do it, obviously, twice. We don't think we'll ever see that again. But when we see Sidney Crosby flirt with the idea of, if this were a full season, being 150, 160-point score, that's probably as good as we're going to get now. It was wide-open hockey, a lot of teams coming from the WHA. It was all there for Gretzky. Goalies didn't seem very good at the start of the 80s, and he took advantage.
And the equipment was, what, 40% smaller than it is right now?
By the way. Yeah.
Yeah, so is 150 the new 200? Probably. That's a good way to put it.
Mike Tyson released from jail after serving 3 years in prison.
I want to eat his children.
That guy, too. The most memorable Tyson moment in your mind?
I hate to say it, it's the ear biting.
It's the ear biting?
I mean, and then Jim Gray interviewing him afterwards. After everything that happened, and thinking that Jim Gray is going to get punched by Tyson.
Yeah, his ear bitten.
Exactly.
Exactly.
There was the other interview too. I wish I could remember who did it. The host was still in the studio, and Tyson was in outside of ring in an arena, and Tyson
wearing
was just so
jacket.
Uncomfortable. That's right.
He was late in the '90s to wear a jean jacket.
He was wearing a jean jacket. Yeah, I wish I could remember
Russ
the interviewer.
Salzberg, who used to
Thank
work
you.
At City TV.
Yes, yeah. That's who did. And but. Just watching Tyson so visibly uncomfortable, and he's not even in the same state as the interviewer. It was very bizarre.
We had big plans in Red Wings Carolina, third game of the Stanley Cup Finals. We're like, this game will get over at 9:30, and then we'll all go watch the Tyson-Lewis fight. It was Mike Tyson and Lennox Lewis from the Pyramid in Memphis. And then the Wings game was the famous triple overtime game when Igor Larionov scored, and the fight was over before the hockey game was over. It's not quite what we expected.
You're like, great, thanks, guys.
Yeah, but it ended, yeah. And then we're back 5 hours later at the arena. On this date in 1989, hitting number one on the charts, get your hankies ready. No, not those kind of hankies. Mike and the Mechanics, The Living Years. I do Messed Up. I still have my dad with me. I still Messed Up when I... See, it's happening, and... No, this song in Live's Lightning Crashes, which is about, like, I think babies being born and people dying. They both made me Messed Up. Come on, look at you. You're barely hanging in there.
I know. That's what I'm trying to hold on.
All the things you want to say to, you know, Mr. Lang. Yeah, jeez.
You know, the video doesn't help either because they really tug at your heartstrings in the video, too.
Oh, stop.
Yeah.
Stop. Mike Rutherford's best work was with Genesis. Come on.
Well, no one's making that art. Yes,
yes,
of course.
But this song, the Genesis
what,
did write a song
better
like
than
this.
Silent Running? Or All I Need Is a Miracle, or Taken In. I can keep going. No, I can't actually. I only know four songs.
That was impressive. Taken In.
I only know the four songs. But geez, I mean, come on. What, like, do girls Messed Up at this?
No, this is a guy
guys
song.
Guys and their dads.
Yeah,
jeez,
it is.
It's like the end to Field of Dreams. Only guys understand.
No,
that.
But see,
it's
that,
worse than it's the worst. This is
me.
No, this is worse
no,
than the end of Field
this,
of Dreams.
This has never
it
gotten
really
me
is.
Ever. But the end of Field of Dreams gets me. Can we have a catch? Oh, my God. I lose it.
Yeah, but this is real. People die. This is a fake, bunch of fake baseball players coming out of a cornfield. Come on.
Nope. Sorry.
And my dad came back to life after being deceased. It would creep me out. It was more creepy than anything. It was like Flatliners. That's
no, that
what it
was creepy.
Like. Birthdays quick. Elton John turns how old today?
Sir Elton is 63.
I think he's a little older. 66.
He is 66, as a matter of fact. Aretha Franklin.
70?
Not quite. Is she 67?
71.
Wow.
Would you,
no.
Aretha? What, 1966?
Not even in her prime.
What, not even in her prime?
Shame
on
me.
She was pretty. You're acting like she was like a giant fat person trapped in a skinny body in 1966. You guys know better. What a couple of sexist pigs. 5:55, 6 o'clock update. Leafs Bruins are on tonight. If we still have our license on Sportsnet 590, the Fan, we'll give away Leafs tickets to go see the Florida Panthers at 7:10 during Name That Leaf. Loads to do. Stay with us. Brady and Lang on Sportsnet 590, the Fan.
School your coworkers around the water cooler. Your brain drinks here. You're listening to Brady and Lang on Sportsnet 590, the Fan.
Seidenberg knocked over by Orr. Puck is still in the corner. Orr trying to get it out in front. McLaren's back. It scores! Laser McLaren! Between the legs and in!
Colton Orr, their line, McLaren scores a big goal. You know, it ends up being the winner. You know, it's nice to see those guys rewarded for their hard work.
Randy Carlyle, of course, after a Leafs victory over the Boston Bruins, the first in 9 games, a bit of a vanquishing of a lot of bad memories over the last several months. I wouldn't even say several, try 18 or 19. Leafs haven't beat them since March of 2011 when they went on a bit of a run, beat them in the shootout. And I think it was everybody's fear last night that, or Saturday, that that game was going to a shootout at some point in time between the Leafs and Bruins. But Toronto held them off despite getting badly outshot. A lot of those even strength shots. You look on the night, Boston only had one power play on the entire evening, and it was very late, 7 minutes into the third period. And full credit to the Leafs. They were probably, I don't think you can argue, outplayed considerably, and yet their goaltender was great. But I don't look at that and say, hey, that's not a worthy 2 points. Your goalie's part of the team, and if he plays that much better than the other goalie, why would anyone complain about the win? Toronto was needing 2 points desperately against Boston. They went and got it. Congratulations.
And for all the shots the Bruins had, the one thing the Leafs did defensively, and this is as an entire team that I thought worked to their favor, Greg, both Tyler Seguin and Milan Lucic, neither one of them had a shot on goal. So you got two of the best snipers in the Bruins held off the shot sheet. And I think that's a big accomplishment for the Leafs, especially the way Seguin has been a real Leaf killer in the last few games. So that was big. And the McLaren thing is shocking. I mean, I sort of dawned on me. I looked it up during the game. But McLaren only has one fewer goal than Milan Lucic. And so the fourth line, when they chip in like that, Colton with a big hit, create the play, McLaren scoring the goal, that added a little bit something. And you could see Julian's like, that's it. Get him out of there. Put Tuukka Rask in. Because he had it. That was it. It was like, I can't take this anymore.
Isn't it possible after McLaren scored that Khudobin will announce his retirement today? Isn't
yes.
I mean, it's not. I kid. But honestly, the goal is a big momentum boost to get that. It's when you get it. And yes, of course, it does matter who gets it. Sports is also, I think we can all agree on this. It's often a series of random occurrences, and you got to do the work to put yourself in a position for something random to happen. But that's exactly what that was. Boston gets their first goal of the hockey game, and we didn't see the Orr McLaren line again. Randy Carlyle pushes the envelope. To me, it's like a guy leading off base just a little bit, and then the throws come over, and you better stick a bit closer to home. But he's like that with that fourth line, and it's the way to get, when everyone else is healthy, unfortunately or fortunately, it's the way to get Jay McClement some ice time, because he's playing with Orr and McLaren. He happened to win the faceoff that got them, you know, in position to get the goal, got the assist on at a minute 34 in, and it was a rare offensive zone faceoff as well for Orr and McLaren. You'd rather have them down at the other end than taking the draw on their own, and which they did a couple times on Saturday. But it may be a random occurrence, but it was a big occurrence, and maybe it kept Boston from gaining any early momentum in the third period.
The other thing I thought the Leafs did well is Johnny Boychuk couldn't dress. He had a lower body injury, so they had a young guy named Matt Barkowski, and they exposed him a couple times last night or Saturday night. Mm-hmm. He was a -2 at the end of the game, so it's deceiving. They only had 13 shots in goal, but whatever shots they had, they made the most of it and really were able to cash in whatever scoring opportunities the Bruins allowed them.
Yeah, they miss Adam McQuaid and they miss Johnny Boychuk.
You
take two of any six defensemen that play top 4 minutes off the team like that, and Boston's in trouble. So you're a Leafs observer / supporter. How did you feel Saturday night, finally vanquishing Boston? Or do you look and say, look, it just happens sometimes, but our goalie stole the damn game. He was unbelievable. And I know where things are at with James Reimer and some people. Some people don't consider him a top-half goalie. He allows 4 against Buffalo Thursday, and they lose in the shootout, and people all of a sudden start talking like they need an upgrade again in net. 416-870-0590, *590, 888-666-0590, or you can text us, 590-590. We'll get to more on the NHL. Brandon Morrow is a Pittsburgh Penguin. Guy Boucher fired in Tampa, but we're sticking with the Leafs and Bruins right now. Were they totally outplayed, outgunned on Saturday, and the goalie happened to steal the game? Is that a fair observation? I mean, I didn't question their effort. I think they've had three really good efforts against Boston this year. But puck possession-wise and opportunity-wise, they're not in a position yet with the talent on their roster and the talent on Boston to be able to touch them. Not a lot of teams are.
Well, no, and when you're outshot 13-4 in the third period, that would tend to think that ice was tilted in Boston's favor for that entire period. So it's one of those victories the Leafs needed, I think, in a lot of ways, Greg, that knowing that they got outshot, they cashed in whatever chances they had. Their goalie stood up big to infuse them with some confidence. And they almost kind of, it's the pressure valve released afterwards. Hey, we can beat these guys.
Well, and it's
we
not,
found a way to beat them.
Yeah, and that is huge, but it's not just, I don't think, shaking that monkey off their back against Boston. It's beating one of these upper echelon teams in the Eastern Conference, because it really seems as though there are two tiers in the conference, right? Once you, and you got to include Montreal in that right now, with Montreal, Boston, and Pittsburgh up there near the top, and then you've got sort of everybody else below that. So the Leafs play well in losing a shootout against Pittsburgh not too long ago, but then they finally get rid of this, which I'm positive was weighing on them mentally, this stigma against the Boston Bruins.
Yeah,
they can beat them and show themselves that, look, if we're going to finish in a 7 or 8 seed, we can skate with some of the better teams in this conference.
We've documented how many goals they're starting to give up. They played the same amount of games as Ottawa, and they've given up 22 more goals. And they haven't had a goaltending injury other than the couple weeks Reimer was off. So I understand people questioning the goaltending, but you're right, Mike. Pittsburgh and Boston, if you talk to the average Leafs fan, I don't think it's delusional. It's just the Eastern Conference. Who would you sweat in a first-round playoff series besides Pittsburgh and Boston? Even if you drew Montreal in a 2-7, if Montreal could somehow hold Boston off and win the division, there would be Leafs fans that, because of how they played in Montreal already this year twice, would like their chances, or at least would call it a pick'em series. Even though Montreal, probably you give them the goaltending check mark, you might give them the coaching check, I don't know. You'd give them some check marks and say, this is what they're better at than Toronto. But you wouldn't rule it out. I wouldn't rule it out.
No, and none of the players in the dressing room would rule it out because of the past experience. They would feel in their hearts and minds that we've done this before, we can do it again. But there's always going to be that doubt with those teams like Pittsburgh and Boston, just because this was not an insignificant win Saturday. And to echo to your points earlier, Greg, they can come up with a point tonight in Boston that sets themselves up very good for the week ahead, especially some of the teams they're about to face.
Yeah, we got a text in, 590-590. Any given Sunday comes to mind about the Leafs win against Boston. But there's some accuracy to that. And not just that, Boston's missing their two defensemen, but the Leafs did miss John Michael Lyles with the cut in his skate. So you're rolling with five defensemen the rest of the way, and that should be a situation that the Bruins can exploit a little bit. And I don't disagree about Lucic. No one's comparing McLaren to Lucic. They're not even close to the same skill and level of hockey. But people in Boston are kind of questioning what's going on with Lucic. He hasn't scored a goal in 15 games. I noticed Sagan on rushes. I did not notice Lucic very much at all. And like you said, Mark Fraser plastered him at one point. And I don't expect Lucic to get up and look around for somebody to dummy and somebody to fight. But he has really, really struggled to get involved in chances and put the puck in the net. A year ago at this time, if we were picking Canadian Olympic teams, he's always in the conversation. And he was in Vancouver's conversation. He just happened to be injured, despite being 21 years of age. He can't play with the best 12 forwards in our country the way he's playing right now. No way.
And the Bruins, with all their talent, their inability sometimes to score goals and create offensively, really does stoke the trade fires about Chiarelli looking to add another forward, someone who can put the puck in the net.
McLaren.
Right. I don't know if you can have them now. Other than McLaren, to help their offense for the stretch drive, because I think in their minds they must think we have the defensive goaltending. We add another forward, maybe we can get over the hump.
That takes us to where we're going now. And by the way, Leafs Bruins tonight, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Our coverage obviously begins at 7:00, right after primetime sports, and the post game show, which was remarkably entertaining Saturday with Gord Stellick, Rick Natras. They'll cover it all for you. From Boston, Mass. Tonight, Leafs are home against Florida and Carolina the rest of the week before Saturday's game. And the funny thing is about Boston is they seemed, reports came in yesterday, they were really deep in on Brandon Morrow, who Pittsburgh got from the Dallas Stars for a young Joe Morrow coming back. They switched third round and fifth round picks in the deal as well. Morrow plays out with Portland in the Western League and was drafted, I think he was two picks after Tyler Biggs, two picks before Stuart Percy. So he's 23rd overall from 2011. The Leafs, he had to have been on the Leafs radar if he ended up getting picked there. And the Leafs had the two picks after the Gardner trade.
But a good deal for Morrow from his personal perspective. Let me look at the team he's about to join. I mean, he couldn't have done much more for the Dallas Stars franchise in his 13 years than he had done. I mean, he'd give it everything, and I think he...
Question is what's left, right?
Well, what's left, but I think if you're Pittsburgh, you're only expecting him to do so much because of the talent around him. If he can give them a couple things, play some quality minutes, a little bit of leadership, then he'd be a nice fit in that dressing room.
Yeah, I'm a little curious about this one. When you look at just the stats, 6 goals, 11 points, 29 games this season, but we're starting to read and hear a lot more about the so-called moneyballization of hockey, and Ray Shero is one of the guys that is sort of a convert, one of the early adoptees of this whole philosophy. The James Neal is a great example when Pittsburgh picks him up, and nobody really thinks that he's going to be the kind of player he turns into, and all of a sudden he's a 40-goal scorer for your hockey club, and they looked at a bunch of different things, not just the typical statistics we've looked at in hockey. So I wonder if the Pittsburgh is seeing something in Morrow that he fits in different ways.
And if you think Dallas got burned on trading James Neal for Goligoski, they're risking it again. If they really think Morrow's going to turn into a 1-2 defenseman that can play, they're few and far between. It's the toughest position to adapt to coming out of junior. But it's intriguing where Dallas is, isn't it, guys? I mean, you know, they got a UFA in Derek Roy. They had one in Brandon Morrow. They have one in Yager. And they're eighth right now in the Western Conference. So everyone's fear about trade deadline day. Hey, nobody will do anything because there's 26 buyers and 4 sellers. This is Dallas and Joe Nieuwendyk saying either we don't think Morrow is that critical to us. We can get in without him with Ben and Yager and Erickson and the guys we got. Or we're just pulling up stake and saying, this isn't good enough. We got to. They acquired Eric Cole, obviously, from Montreal. So they've got some quality forwards. They just didn't seem to think Morrow was part of the plan or part of the future. He's their captain. They traded him.
And I really believe this is going to set up the domino. I mean, this is something we've all talked about, Greg, is how when this kind of deal happens, how will the floodgates open up? And the reports late in Calgary last night that Jerome McGinley's basically given the okay to waive his no-trade clause to a select number of teams. And there's going to be quite a bidding war, I think, for his services for certain teams who think he's going to be the difference than him getting over the hump.
If Morrow only gets what goes there, is a Ginla, is a, I feel like a Ginla's worth more than Morrow, but God, I
how
mean,
much
that's
more?
Not,
yeah.
That's not a lot. That's not even close to a current first round pick. That's a first round pick late, very late in the first round in Joe Morrow. That's, 23rd, 24th overall, that has probably been a bit below the curve of development for what they might have expected, judging by his junior numbers.
Quickly, Mark Spector sent a tweet out late last night. He says his sources are telling him the Flames are looking for 2 prospects and a draft pick for Ginla. Now, what that means, draft pick, and what they deem prospects, who knows?
And sometimes the prospects are more important than the pick at the end of the day. Coming up next, Vernon Wells comes back to the American League East. But is there anything left in the tank? We know there's lots in his wallet. Capital One doesn't have to ask that. We'll get to that story in a little bit, 6:15.
Now, more of Brady and Lang on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
There's a high fly ball to left field. That's hit pretty well. Back for it, Thames. He's at the track. He's at the wall. He looks up, and it is gone. A home run for Vernon, his 23rd.
Start spreading the news.
Big opportunity now for Vernon Wells, traded yesterday from the L.A. Angels of Anaheim to the Toronto Blue Jays. The Blue Jays, by the way, playing today against the Philadelphia Phillies in Dunedin. You can hear that game on Sportsnet 590.ca at 1 o'clock. A few more games left. They'll play at Philadelphia for 2 games this weekend and then clearly home to get ready for a Honda opening night a week from tomorrow against the Cleveland Indians. But new life, potentially, for Vernon Wells. It feels like he's 38. He's going to turn 34 later this season. The Yankees have agreed to swallow some of the $42 million owed Vernon Wells over the next 2 years, 21 a copy, and the Yankees are going to pay 13 of that 42, leaving the Angels to basically write a check for $29 million and dish the player off. They don't need him, but the Yankees do. Could Vernon Wells help a very injury-riddled New York Yankees?
Only in a very small way. His production drop-off, Greg, is it's stunning to see where he was in 2010 with the Blue Jays when he had 31 home runs and an OPS of 847 to where he's fallen off the last couple of years, and health is a big part of it.
And that was a big comeback year for him off a couple, especially a really bad 2009 when he was getting booed a lot.
Exactly, right. So in 2010, you're thinking, great, hey, maybe he's coming back. He's still a young man, as you said, at that point, and still has some years ahead of him, But my goodness, he's just a shadow of his former self, of the player that really was such a force of nature with the Blue Jays in his prime. And what the Yankees can get out of him as anybody, it just seems like it's a warm body to help fill the lineup until people get healthy. That's what it comes across as, because you don't expect much from him.
You don't do this without desperation it being in the air, Mike. And we can't make the argument, hey, he went somewhere and the team wasn't a contender, they didn't play meaningful games, because the Angels did do that. But it's another crack for him to play a lot of games early on, perhaps with the Curtis Granderson injury. Brennan Bosch, they acquired off just out of nowhere. Detroit had dumped him in the offseason. He's got like a stiff rib cage thing. Everybody's got something in the Yankees camp. And Vernon Wells is probably going to play every day left field for maybe the first 5-6 weeks of the season.
You know, you can't use the fresh start, new change of scenery kind of thing anymore, I don't think, because it certainly didn't work for him going to the Angels. And look at the protection he's got over there in that lineup with some of the big bats they had. So now he comes to this injury-riddled Yankees team where he's going to be required to provide some offense, and I don't know how patient the Yankees fans are going to be with a guy like Vernon Wells if he can't get something done.
For the amount of money they pay for tickets, no patience at all. And no matter what, how he slumped, they're going to expect him to do something and be productive and help them win, just because of just the way the Yankees fans and Yankee media view that team.
Our number 416-870-0590, *590. We know how most Blue Jays fans feel about Vernon Wells, and there's nothing, I don't think there's anything bad you can say about the person or even the guy's efforts. He just happens to have dried up a lot earlier than many would have thought as a major league starter, let alone a borderline all-star. He's a three-time all-star, never has played a playoff game, looking for that first opportunity to do that now with the Angels. And last year should have been the year when you have Mike Trout break out like he did and first year of Albert Pujols, but there's no room to play him. He may see this as a great opportunity. And we know about spring training, but he's had a very good spring. He's hitting .340. He's hit 4 home runs. People like the way he looks, and obviously the Yankees have had an eye on him for at least a few days now, and they don't see you don't make this commitment. You're desperate, but you don't make this commitment without knowing the player is all right. You're better off getting a guy who's 37, 30. You better getting a Johnny Damon. Look how desperate the Blue Jays were trying to bring Vladimir Guerrero up through the system. And they weren't even a contender. So the Yankees clearly like something about how Wells looks, how he's playing.
It's always weird to see certain players in Yankees pinstripes. It will be odd. To see the first time he's at bat in Yankees pinstripes, it won't seem right at all, Greg, at all.
Yeah. And look, New York, I think how it hinges in the AL East is everyone was talking yesterday about the payroll and where the Yankees are going to go. And there's all this talk the Yankees are going to try and get under in 2014 a budget of $189 million. Now, ludicrous, but they are paying CeCe Sabathia $24.5 million. They're paying Alex Rodriguez $27 million. None of this counts. Those are the only two players I can find on this list of commitments for 14 to share at $22.5. This does not count a player option for Derek Jeter. This does not count. This is obviously, we know Mariano Rivera is going to retire, so that takes $10 million plus off the books. But this doesn't count Jeter, whose player option is $9.5 million. And how the AL East kind of hinges in the next several years to me is whether they can bring back Robinson Cano. It's everything. It changes them totally from a team that you can see winning the AL East to a team that if their only big boppers are Teixeira, A-Rod, and Sabathia every 5 days, then they can't play with the Blue Jays. And I don't think they can even play with as balanced a team as the Red Sox are, with guys who are going to get older, Pedroia, Ellsbury, the guys they've got. But they're far more balanced than New York is. New York's 5 dudes with heavy payrolls, and they're just filling in spots with pencil crayon everywhere else.
Cano's 30 years old, and he is the heir apparent, really, in a lot of ways for the Yankees with his production the last few years, offensively and defensively. I mean, for my money, he's the best second baseman in baseball.
Yeah, I think he is still.
And so to have a player like that in your middle infield who produces anywhere from the high 20s to low 30 home runs every year and drives in runs like he does and is so consistent at the plate, where do you find guys like that? You have to make sure you lock them up and keep them with the team long term.
But I understand the concern, because if you're even close to the 189 borderline, you've just added Vernon Wells at 6.5 a year this year and next year. So, to me, in a weird way, I know everyone's saying this is their number. I think they're going to go over the number. I think they'll have to go over the number, because you're going to have to pay Robinson Cano $20 million. You may have to pay him $25 million based on the year he has this year. You may have to. I don't know that you get into a 10-year commitment, but is $100 million over 5 years for Robinson Cano? I can see that number in print. I can see it in my own eyes as him getting that.
He's still being his like late 30s, mid to late 30s, so not unreasonable age for him. His health has been pretty good. He's only missed a handful of games in the last 5 years.
Oh, he's fine.
He's very great.
Great World Baseball Classic. That may be the difference. Do you want playoff revenue or do you not? Do you want 95 win teams or do you want 83 win teams? Honestly, that may be the difference for the Yankees.
And really, at the end of the day, Greg, if they go $5-10 million over the 189, they can afford it. It's the Yankees.
It's not that they can't afford it for sure. But yeah, I look at this now. I'm wondering if we don't have to maybe start getting ourselves accustomed to a bit of a changing of the guard. I don't know if it's. Can you even talk about a bit of a downturn in New York? But if you've got Cano at second base, that's great. But who do you have at third? Who do you have at shortstop? I mean, that middle infield is starting to kind of come apart at the seams as players age and get injured now.
Yeah, it's a totally changing landscape. Even this year already. If I told you 5 years ago, forget 10, 5 years ago, in 5 years, the LA Dodgers will have a higher payroll than the Yankees, you'd go, why? Why would they do that? What's the matter with them?
Exactly. Right? My favorite thing on Yahoo is they have a depth chart of every Major League Baseball team of the Yankees that's blank at first base. It's just a blank line.
It's a guy wearing a Riddler suit for Halloween. There's a lot of question marks.
Exactly.
Speaking of question marks, there are some with the Blue Jays. That's for sure. We're a week and a day from opening day. And there's talk Brett Laurie will start the season on the DL. Still hasn't been able to get in a Grapefruit League game. And he's obviously only got a couple chances left. But a lot of people wrote, Richard Griffin did yesterday, about the closer situation and how, if anything, they're 0-0 in the regular season. So what are we going to criticize John Gibbons for? But sort of a gun jumping about Casey Jansen being the closer, instead of either saying we got to wait and see how he is, or we'll leave it as an open competition, because Sergio Santos has put a ton more innings in, hasn't complained about his arm. Jansen's pitched a little bit. And he's already noted there's been soreness, and they shut him down earlier than they wanted to in March. They shut him down the first week of March to make sure his shoulder doesn't flare up. I feel like we're going to see, if the Jays have a lead a week and a day from tomorrow, we're going to see Santos go out for the ninth inning.
But as you sort of noted in our pre-show notes last night, Greg, who cares who the closer is as long as they're closing the games and getting the guys out and sealing the deal? I almost think there's so much made about Jansen or Santos. They keep saying it doesn't matter. Well, it doesn't matter if one or the other is actually the guy getting the ball in the ninth inning. As long as they're being effective and doing the job, that's all we should really care about.
And isn't that what kind of happened last year when Santos wasn't available and everybody thought, oh my gosh, who's going to close games for this team? And all of a sudden, Casey Jansen emerges and he really took to the role. We talked to him about it. He says, yeah, I'm okay with this. I kind of like it. So right now, I'm not too concerned. I'm far more concerned about the Ricky Romero, Jay Happ situation than I am about who's going to close games out in the ninth inning.
So today, really special day in Toronto. We've got two pandas coming in. They're coming from, where pandas come from. Japan?
China.
China? Okay.
Yes, China.
Urshan and Da Mao are arriving at the FedEx hangar at Pearson Airport later today. Prime Minister Harper and his wife are going to be there. China's ambassador to Canada. This is going to be like the reverse of Argo at the end. You're actually going to get them into the country as opposed to out of the country. And I didn't know we have one panda right now at the Toronto Metro Zoo, at the Metropolitan Toronto Zoo. And now he's got like buddies coming in. It's been a lonely go for that panda.
It's amazing. They have a special container called the Panda Express built by FedEx.
I love their food, though.
With a glass opening so the panda can see out with all these air holes through it. So it actually has its own five-star transportation to get from China to North America.
You'll get a look at it this morning. You should even check it out on Breakfast TV. There's an actual giant, there's a panda plane. It's a FedEx plane, like the one that crashed with Tom Hanks in Castaway. Except it's got...
except it won't crash,
yeah,
right?
There's no volleyballs on board. But it's got a picture of a giant panda. We've got a reporter out there. Do we have him there? Yeah? Let's go to Sportsnet 590. He's interning, I think. That's what's happening. Brian Fantana is live at the Metro Toronto Zoo right now with this.
Panda watch. The mood is tense. I have been on some serious, serious reports, but nothing quite like this. Ching King is inside right now. I tried to get an interview with him, but they said, nope, you can't do that. He's a live bear. He will literally rip your face off.
Hey, you're making me look stupid. Get out here, panda jerk.
It's not going that well there, obviously. So
it's not a very nice report.
There's going to be, there's going to be a panda exhibit all summer long, but this is your only chance to see them today until the panda opens. We'll see if that impacts the Canadian economy. I can only hope it will, given that China?
Yes.
Yeah. Then maybe they'll erase some of the North American debt that they're looking to collect over the next several centuries. Right now, you can save $10,000 on an Acura MDX during the Master of the Road sales event. GTA Acura retailers bring you the money game with Mike Eppel on Sportsnet 590. The Fan. See your Acura retailer for details. You're pro Panda, right?
Absolutely. It's
You'll be out to see those two.
You jest and downplay the importance of this.
Oh, no.
Yes.
No, I'm not.
Listen, this could be big business for the Metro Zoo. Let's face it. A lot of people will go out and see these cute and cuddly creatures.
Hazel McCallion's going to be part of the ceremony today. We'll get her out there.
This is big time.
I know.
No doubt about that. So you're right. It's a tourist attraction, and goodness knows we always like money coming into our fair city as opposed to it going out. Money's coming into the markets this morning, guys. A bailout for Cyprus. Yes, you were concerned about this, I know, but the tiny Eurozone nation getting $13 billion of financial aid, the latest crisis averted for the Eurozone, and investors going, exhaling, and they're buying in. The Dow futures pointing to a possible record start to the trading week for the Wall Street blue chip stock indicator. International trade all up by better than 1%. Price for oil up to $94 a barrel. That's a multi-week high, although the price for gas has come down a little bit, so that's good. The price for gold at $16.03 an ounce, and the Canadian dollar 98.08 cents U.S. That's already up by a third of a cent. Big week coming up for BlackBerry. It reports earnings on Thursday, and we'll get the first indication of exactly how those new BlackBerry 10s have been selling in about the first month of sales. So, there you go. Busy week.
More at 8:30. Thanks, Mike. There's Mike Eppel with the Money Game. Coming up, can a CFL player do anything he wants in the offseason? Anything.
Now, more of Brady and Lang on Sportsnet 590. The Fan.
These Bruins tonight, Sportsnet 590. The Fan, as Mike mentioned, Toronto in sixth with 37 points, 3 points behind Ottawa. They'll play in Ottawa Saturday, but three games this week, so it's busy times before Saturday's game at Scotiabank. They're a point ahead of the Devils. They're 4 points ahead of the Rangers. Rangers hold the last playoff spot. Carolina 5 points back. Washington and the Islanders both won yesterday, and both are 6 points back. We'll get to more on that and play Name That Leaf for Panthers, Leafs, tickets. You just can't get those anywhere except in the state of Florida, but we'll give those away at around 7:10 this morning, and we'll touch a little bit as well on this ugly call that Ted Johnson had, a former New England Patriot linebacker calling current New England Patriot nose tackle Vince Wilfork's wife ugly. I hope you guys can behave yourself. You said such nasty things about Aretha Franklin.
We just spoke the truth.
Pretty lady. And you guys had, it's her birthday today, and you guys are slamming her.
Yes, but her husband, I don't believe, is quite the size and power Aretha's as Vince Wilfork's wife. Vince Wilfork might be the biggest athlete I've seen in person in a locker room. I don't know what Ted Johnson was thinking. That's the last guy I want to make angry.
It's not, yeah. And he found out about it pretty quickly. But we'll stay with football. And Chad Owens, Grey Cup hero. We've had him in on the show many times, and he certainly is an incredibly friendly guy, is going to make his MMA debut, and it's actually next week, April 6th, in Honolulu. He will fight Yunya Marvelous Tavaga of Maui, Chad Owens will, also appearing in his first MMA bout. And the Argos aren't exactly happy about this. At first, it was kind of quiet for a couple days. We found out about this on Wednesday, but here's Jim Barker's money quote from Friday's Toronto Star. Dan Ralph's story, the CP story. I think he's making a bad decision. Organization thinks he's making a bad decision. But we don't have control of what players choose to do and not do in the offseason. We trust Chad. He's been in the best shape of any athlete in this league for the last 3 years. We trust that. We think he made a bad decision on doing this, but again, we trust he'll come in great shape and be ready to play. What are both of your observations of Chad Owens deciding to do this? This isn't exactly saying, I'm going to go surfing. This isn't exactly saying, I'm going to bungee jump. This is, I'm going to get in a ring and another man might pummel me. He might concuss me. He might, you know, break my clavicle. He might break a cheekbone. How do you view it?
This is a big mistake for me, for Chad. I think he thinks it's not a big deal. His quote in the Globe story as well, it's kind of like football. What's the big deal? I'll try something new. Words to that effect. You're risking too much. You are arguably the most important player on the Argos offense, along with Ricky Ray. You're the reason why they won the Grey Cup. You set a CFL record for all-purpose yards. The fact there's no clause in the CFL contracts that don't allow them to do this or allow them to do this is beyond me, Greg. But now this is a big mistake, and it's taking too much of a risk for the team.
You got to wonder if part of this is the whole the fact that the CFL players, as we know, are not exactly the best paid athletes out there, and they spend their time in the offseason working other jobs so that they can make a living outside of football. But you can be in the best shape you want to be. It's an entirely different story to step into the octagon, as they call it, and potentially have your brains beaten in by your opponent. I think this is absolutely foolish.
But could he make the case that if he plays it the right way, he's going in against a guy with no experience as well, that this is safer, at least, you know, I know there's combat involved, but we saw Aaron Boone of the New York Yankees rip up his leg playing basketball. You've seen guys in boating accidents. You've seen guys, tear ligaments water skiing or even just plain running. I mean, I don't know how you can blame somebody for running in the off season of their sport, but GMs and owners will often say there are guys that take off season seriously and there are guys that overdo it and are risk takers. And this seems to be, is Chad Owens an adrenaline junkie? Does he need to do this? I'd be fascinated to find out how much he's getting for this, because if this is a case where, I'll just throw numbers out there, if this is a case where he's getting $25,000 for the fight, that's one thing. If he's getting $2,000, this is ridiculous. Well, like, it's money's money, but it has to factor into this call here.
He's in the final year of his contract, and with bonuses, I think he made in the vicinity of $175,000 with all his clauses he cashed in. So it's not horrible money by CFL standards. He's not wealthy by any
means.
Well
above average.
Oh, yeah, absolutely well above average, Greg. Absolutely well above. Being paid more than most of his teammates in a lot of ways. But, as you said, it better be worth it, because all it takes is one punch the wrong way. If it's the concussion's bad enough, we've seen with so many examples of athletes, is that the season? I mean, what if the concussion is so bad from an incident in the octagon that he's not ready for training camp, that he's not ready for the start of the regular season?
416-870-0590, *590. Should the Argos be able to tell Chad Owens yay or nay on doing this? Now, there's no dialogue in the contract that says they can't. There's no verbiage in the contract that says they can prevent him from doing this. I'm looking at video because I totally remembered this happening of, I guess there's a fighting organization called K1, and Johnny Morton, the former wide receiver, right? Lions, Chiefs, went to USC, did a K1 fight back in 2009. Now, it was a couple of 3 years after he retired. This is like Johnny Dangerously. He fought K1 once, and just got demolished by this guy named Bernard Aka. But that's to say, this is a former NFL player doing all the training. He was a fitness freak when he was in Detroit, thought he could handle this, and just they took him out. They took him out on a stretcher with his neck stabilized. That's how badly he got beat up.
But see, this is part of the problem too, Greg. There's so many athletes who think, I'm a great athlete, I'm in perfect shape, I could do this. But then they get into that realm and realize, I can't do this because I don't know the little things. And a real fighter will know some certain tricks and certain things that would be able to exploit whatever Chad Owens has an experience he hasn't earned from years of training in the octagon.
Or even if he knew wrestling tricks like eye gouges and Fuji salt.
Exactly. I was just going to mention the salt.
Just come to the ring with a crutch and then use that crutch.
It's a great
like
idea.
Roddy Piper would have.
Or the object in the belt line, right?
His opponent won't expect it. If he comes in with a crutch. He'll think, oh, this is going to be easy. Look at the guy's got a crutch.
You know, spray Rick Martel's arrogance in his eyes before the fight. You'd be amazed how easy it would go, right?
Look at that, Chad Owens is a chair.
I could beat up a lot of guys blinded by cologne. Some of our listeners even. So we'll see how this goes. I'm sure we'll get video on Connected the night after it happens, but it is coming up next week, and I think it's way too late. There's nothing the Argos could say or do that's going to make Owens pull out of this? And I know it's a free country and everything, but any employer wants his employee, especially when it involves something that's of a physical nature, to, I suppose, be as cautious as they can be. We know from the Roethlisberger stuff, there are clauses now for NFL players that are so airtight. Don't ride a motorcycle. Don't water ski. Don't even get involved playing, you know, another sport in intramurally. Don't coach your kids. You'll be straining money. You know, don't coach your kids in the offseason. That's in some guys' clauses.
Most of the CFL players I know are teachers in the offseason, maybe work in construction. Some guys work in retail sales. But they don't have the clause in the contract because this hasn't really come up very much before that it's necessary to tell a guy he can't do MMA fighting in the offseason and risk, you know, injury, maybe your career.
Now, I suppose sad news from the bodybuilding industry, although is it sad? I mean, if you live till 93 and you're in great health, is that sad? That's a great living. We'll all take 93. Some of us want to go even earlier. But I'll tell you, Joe Weider, you know the name Weider, spelled W-E-I-D-E-R, if you've ever done anything involving working out, or even, you know, it's like those Ed Allen, you know, aerobics things that were on CBC early in the morning during the weekdays that my grandmother would work out to. Joe Weider died at the age of 93 yesterday. Didn't know he was, you know, he grew up in the streets of Montreal and a huge mentor for Arnold Schwarzenegger in the early 70s. There was the Joe Weider hand grips. You mentioned there's like the shake powder, protein. Like the protein powder. Oh. This is long before today's technologies. But yeah, you'd mix it in, you know, white powder, chocolate powder with milk, and there'd be just an obscenely, you know, gross figure of a built guy, and you'd go, I will take this powder, and I will look like that man. And it doesn't work. But anyway, well, it probably helps.
But Joe Weider, I mean, along with discovering Arnold Schwarzenegger in Austria, what he did is he took bodybuilding from a real cult sport, a real fringe sport, and
despite, where it
belongs. Yeah, well, no, but despite all the naysayers, turned it into a multi-billion dollar fitness industry. He played a big part in that with Arnold Schwarzenegger, with Muscle and Fitness magazine, with his supplements, with his exercise things. And it became this idea that it's okay to stay in shape and work out after you're a young guy as you get older. And here's how I'm going to help you do it. And he, I mean, really, all the fitness gyms we see and all the supplements, it all traces back to the beginnings of what he started.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree more. And I really do think that with what Weider did for Arnold Schwarzenegger, and then Arnold Schwarzenegger took everything, he really took it mainstream for a while. Honestly, when you think about Pumping Iron as a documentary and the whole Schwarzenegger Ferrigno battle that was going on, then Ferrigno becomes a freaking TV star with the Incredible Hulk. I mean, honestly, these guys brought bodybuilding and fitness really into the mainstream.
And he would bring guys, there was a guy named Tom Platz, who was a champion bodybuilder in Michigan, and he would discover guys and became Gold's Gym in Venice Beach, California, and Joe Weider was like the Svengali who helped train you, and guys descended upon Gold's Gym in Venice Beach as Mecca. And you would come from all parts of the world, all parts of North America, to train there to be the next great bodybuilder to try to beat Schwarzenegger and guys like that.
And the principles of Weider are still in, you know, being used today, the basic principles that he established.
It's an amazing legacy. I can't help but wonder if he laid in bed on certain nights and just thought, are we oiling up too much? Because that's the one issue I think a lot of people have with the industry is how much body oil was
so
used.
He's laying in bed thinking of that and then realizing he's got to do the sheets again the next day.
That, per se. Yeah. Right. Your sheets are covered in oil the next day. Now, speaking of size, Ted Johnson, the former New England Patriot, went on the radio in Houston. And I guess this is a segment where they have an athlete on and you're allowed to ask anything. Well, a caller called up and asked Ted Johnson who the ugliest, least attractive wife or girlfriend was of an ex-teammate. And it just happens to be a current player, and that current player found out about this very quickly. And there's a bit of a blood feud going on. Chad Owens might be on the undercard next week at his fight. Here's the call involving Ted Johnson and the hosts in Houston.
Of all of the players that he's played with on his teams, who's got the ugliest spouse? I need his name.
The ugliest spouse?
That's a great
yes! Oh, my gosh.
What a great question.
Right.
Hugh. If you don't win, man, I'll take you to Twin
you know
Peaks,
what?
Brother.
I got it.
You got it.
Yeah, I got it.
Yes.
Oh, and this
man.
Is and this is a big, big man.
Okay.
And this guy had his way with the Texans this year.
Oh, I know who it is.
I know who it is.
And he's a great guy. And his
the
wife,
all-time
and his wife
best.
Seems like a great guy. Great gal, I should say. Looks like a great guy. Seems like a great
yeah.
gal.
Oh. That's
gosh.
He won't hear this. Vince Wolford.
All right, next item.
Big mistake, Ted. Big mistake.
What are you thinking?
Literally, it's a big
Come
mistake.
On.
Don't do it, Ted. What are you thinking?
That's like the third rail of sports
exactly.
questions. Don't just no
Although
comment
Matthew Barney
in a way.
Joked the other day that people were dressing up as his wife with like hair under his armpits at you know defending Lyle Odoline in that Pittsburgh Montreal playoff series.
Bit of a difference in size between Barnaby and
I don't know Ford. That. I'm not commenting on Barnaby's wife. He's just across the border.
No, I meant Barnaby and Wilford.
I'd still. They'll both come after us. 6:56, it's Brady and Lang. We'll play Name That Leaf for Leafs-Panthers tickets coming up in a little bit.